The topic for this evening is Kriyas HaTorah, although we still have a few leftovers from last shiur, which was about women in tefillah. And for those who are interested in the schedule, you'll find it right behind you by the window, and we'll try to keep to at least to the best of our ability. Last time we were speaking about what we called women's tefillah groups. We read from the tradition magazine of the Rabbinical Council of America, Winter 1998, which is a lengthy piece, over 100 pages, written by two wonderful brothers, Frimmer brothers, Aryeh and Dov Frimmer, in which they are not so happy with a responsum, a brief responsum, which was signed by five Rabbonim, myself included, way back in December of 1984. We're holding in the month of December again. So you figure out how many years ago that was. And what bothered them was primarily the word usser that was used. The Rabbanim who signed it were careful when they referred to two of the great rabbinical leaders of the generation, both Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Moshe Feinstein, to use the word misnagdim, that they were opposed. We didn't put the word usser into anybody else's mouth other than our own. And there's a lengthy piece about why is it really usser, and the Rabbi Shechter wrote many reasons why it's usser. They don't see why these reasons are so persuasive. But they then proceed to quote Rav Soloveitchik at great length. We read some of the excerpts last time. And just based on what they were saying, it seemed to me that, as they say in our language, Mimokom Shabasa, from the quotes which they themselves cite there from numerous interviews with those who had spoken to Rav Soloveitchik about it, it came out that he was very strongly opposed to it, exactly as we said. Now, whether the word usser is to be used or not, it's a matter of judgment and somewhat a matter of semantics. As I often have said, someone, for example, he doesn't make Kiddush, doesn't light candles, doesn't make Abdullah, doesn't bench. Is that usser? What do you think?
Also to eat after not making
whatever it may be. The bottom line is you want to be technical. So what? I didn't do any isser. I just didn't fulfill the mitzvah I was supposed to do it. I would say it's usser. Because when I use the word usser, I'm using it in the more general sense. And the Rav was very, very brisk in that sense. You know, he didn't want to use the word usser when it wasn't, you know, a capital Aleph. But his opposition was quite clear, pronounced, and I must say prescient. He predicted everything was going to happen after his time, as he saw it developing, as we spoke last time, as it developed in his lifetime, in the 15 or so years that they were quoting him from the early 70s till to the end of his public career. And he was, I feel confident in saying that what we said in his name, Misnagdim, is true. And I think the same is true of Feinstein's opinion, despite attempts to cloud that opinion as well. Bottom line is that we have to be concerned, as I mentioned last time, with nothik mine churba. Now that's an expression which the Gemara has in Masechta Sukkah about a case in which there's no kosher esrog in town, and the question whether they should take a non-kosher esrog, at least have some kind of a semblance, you know, at least a nice idea, the spirit of the law. You know, we like these things, right? You know, and for example, some who feel that we're just in finishing Hanukkah, that a Hanukkah menorah cannot be electric. I'm not going to the halachic part right now. Assume that an electric menorah is not a valid way to fulfill the mitzvah. But you know, it gives you a taste and a feeling, and it's nice, and it's fuzzy, and it's warm, and it's cozy. So let's just advocate these electric menorahs. And someone may say the opposite. Dilma nafik mine churba. Someone will think that the electric menorah is a kosher menorah. Someone will say that the lemon is a kosher esrog. And someone will say that, you know, from this, something bad is going to come out. This figures in is an integral part of the halachic process. One who claims that I'm not going to take into account any future problems right now, if there's no formal prohibition, let's go for it, is not acting halachically. That's what I call in my time halachic policy, not public policy. Public policy conveys an impression that any Tom, Dick, and Harry can have a different public policy because it's a matter of public policy. I'm part of the public, John Q. Public, as they call it in this country. John Q. Public, in fact, can opine on public policy matters, though there are those who are more or less qualified to state their positions. But in halachic policy, it goes to the halachists, the other ones who are entrusted to safeguard the halachic system, the halachic process, and make sure that things are not going to go wrong. And if they said, don't take this lemon, even though it looks nice and feels nice, and you can't do it. Yes, I'm sorry.
But the halachist has to take into account the public opinion.
Absolutely. Every halachist worth his salt is cognizant of what people are saying out there. But just because they're saying certain things, this doesn't mean it changed the halachist opinion. To give a current example, I'm quoting from our own Mr. Turkel. We spoke about the brain death issue, which has come up again. What's the public going to say? So therefore, there's a movement afoot that even if an opinion is advanced, that from the pure halachic perspective of measuring the laws of murder, which are very serious laws, that the brain death is not death, because the person is still breathing and the person's heart's still beating. We're not going into the details of that right now. Nonetheless, we should change our minds and espouse a different opinion, because the public is not ready to accept to go away from a brain death criterion, which, mind you, was unheard of 50 years ago. Unheard of. No one ever heard of it. Let's put things in a bigger perspective. Now people have gotten used to it because it's convenient. So for the rabbis to vote their conscience, if they really feel that halakhically brain death is not death, would be go counter to public opinion, so maybe we should change our minds and rule differently. This, of course,
it's more like they said, the people who said that this is murder also say, but an organ which was taken in this manner can be used.
I'm not discussing
therefore,
that. That's not my.
Therefore, somebody will say, "Oh, you guys are willing to take my organs, but you're not willing to give your own organs," and that causes a public, impression which reflects ban on halakha, and therefore we might want to, adjust what we think.
Maybe people should adjust what they think in respect to the halacha, instead of the halacha should adjust what it thinks.
I was saying the word Eva has been used to adjust halacha, because sometimes you have to worry about what the guy thinks.
That's true. There are situations between Eva, Hikili, Rabbanan, and rabbinic prohibitions, which are of a lesser magnitude. There are times where we permit certain things, Mishum Eva. But you do not find that we can murder Mishum Eva. I never heard of that.
I didn't say that. I said
well, that's what you're saying. Because you said brain death is not death, and we should kill him anyway, because Mishum Eva. That's what you said. I'm just quoting you. I heard you say it a minute ago. Now, I'm much more sympathetic to what you're saying than I'm saying right now. But suffice it to say that the halacha does take into account Eva and public opinion and things. And it is. It's brought into the calculus. And it should be. I think it should be. That's in terms of how we phrase things and how we pronounce things and how we make statements. I agree with you 100%. Nonetheless, it seems to me that over here the halacha is clear that these women's prayer services were not accepted by the great rabbis of the time. And as I spoke about in the last year, changes of such major significance cannot be made in our halachic system without major halachic forces giving an unambiguous endorsement. There is no one of a major halachic level given an unambiguous support to these women's prayer groups. And for that, to my mind, we have no right to make this change. I mean, leave the word usher out for the moment. We have no right to make certain changes. That's my feeling. Now, more recently, a new development has come to the fore in our little tiny community. We are such a small community. We can fit into one tiny corner of some of these major Jewish communities, wherever they may be, but some of this little square mile that we have over here seems to be the epicenter of some of the issues of the day. So this past summer, Shabbos Kodesh, Parshas Ekev, I thought history was being made, Kabbalah Shabbos in the Young Israel of Riverdale, right here in this building. That's what I thought. Why? The first time in my 36, almost 37 years here in this community, after they finished the Chododi, the Baal Tefillah, whose names will remain nameless for the moment, the Baal Tefillah decided that because of a particular family occasion, a wonderful Simcha in a family, which has encompassed most of the community, we're going to do a rikud around the bima. Now, I've never seen that in all my years over here. a rikud around the bima. I did not participate in that rikud. I felt that they didn't consult with the rav, that the rav should not be pulled into this rikud. But I did didn't protest, didn't stop it, and it was a very beautiful rikud. And I thought we were making headlines. The Kabbalah Shabbos in Riverdale of that Shabbos Kodesh was to be so historic and so momentous that it would bite, you know, wow, they're dancing in the shul.
When Rabbi Schlesinger opened up his shul, he danced for at least 10 minutes throughout the shul, he leading the dancing.
So there you go. So we have the endorsement of great, great, great rabbis. So
only one time.
It's only happened once so far. Now I'm not going to guarantee it's going to go 36 more years before they do it again. I can't. Once the thing starts, it starts. But if it happened once in Rabbi Schlesinger, for those who don't know, Rabbi Schlesinger is one of the greatest rabbonim that we have today. A person whose Torah is spread not only in his own community in Muncie, but through the media, through tapes and CDs, well beyond the Muncie community. I'm a major fan of his tapes. Only thing I have to know Yiddish to be able to understand it. But if you understand Yiddish, I recommend it very, very highly. Okay, so I thought there was some kind of headline. Okay, good. All of a sudden, I hear some talk. There was a family simcha Shabbos, and some people from out of the community were talking, and they had seen something in the newspaper that day, apparently. And I hear that, what we did was nothing. This change of having a little rikud around the bima, I thought it was pretty radical. Garnished. There was apparently an email sent out, which was picked up by the newspapers, which were printed in advance of that Shabbos. The official day was Friday. So at exactly the same time that we thought history was being made in our own little corner, garnished, we were eclipsed by a long shot. Because apparently in another part of the community, there was a somewhat more radical change in the Kabbalah Shabbos service. Anyone know what I'm talking about?
Sure. A woman led the service.
A woman led the service. And this sparked this. This Kabbalah Shabbos. I'm not discussing Marav now. Singing, of course. Shul, which is. I'm not going there. The shul is officially an Orthodox shul. Now, this sparked a tremendous controversy. I was asked to speak about it at the time. I refused. Always have to look back a few months later. I don't like to speak, you know, just like this. That happened in the end of the month of July. We're now holding the month of December. Okay, so it's nearly a half a year later. If you look at the perspective of a half a year, we can talk about it with a little bit sense of a balance. This sparked, from what I'm told, and again, I haven't researched everything so carefully, some of my facts may be wrong. From what I was told and what I read in newspapers, but you can't trust the accuracy of newspapers. That's clear. As a caveat before I even start, there was apparently a major controversy within the synagogue itself, with a number of influential members pulling out over this somewhat dramatic change in the synagogal practice, and the controversy went beyond the synagogue and beyond a little community. It became a national issue with various types of responses, including those who say, well, this shul is obviously not Orthodox, including those who said, this is a great idea, what's wrong? Technically speaking, well, Kabbalah Shabbos is not really part of the Davim, you all know that. Kabbalah Shabbos, in some shuls, a kid under bar mitzvah sings Kabbalah Shabbos. And in some shuls, including ours, Kabbalah Shabbos is not said from the omer in the front, which indicates it's a formal part of davening, but it's from the bima, you know, towards the back. And in some shuls, it's not said at all because it's not. You won't find it anywhere in the Shulchan Aruch. You just won't find it. It's just a later innovation. And therefore, how can you be restrictive about something which doesn't even exist? Right? You don't have to do it at all. So how can it be problematic if a woman does it? Now there is an issue which someone implied in the question, a kol isha issue. There is a prohibition known as kol b'isha erva, which is that a man is not supposed to hear the sound of a woman's singing voice. That is a significant issue, very significant. It's not the topic for tonight, but there are those who maintain that there's no such prohibition. I'm not saying within the mainstream of halacha, but they're in the mainstream of the particular synagogue that I'm referring to, even though it may not be the mainstream or the general halacha consensus.
No, such prohibition at all, or right. In the case, I think they were saying in the case of Dovashivikudu.
No. There were those days no such prohibition at all. It's only a problem during Kriya Shema, based upon the location of the prohibition in Masechet Brachos and the context of Kriya Shema. There's no such prohibition whatsoever. There are others who say, so that's not within the mainstream at all. But others say, this is not within certain mainstream authorities, that since it's Dovashah B'Kedusha, they're not singing love songs, but they're singing holy songs, songs of this type of nature, that there is no prohibition of Kol B'Yisharav. That is a position which is found within, we'll call it the mainstream of halacha. You know, the mainstream is a pretty wide stream. And that is certainly an issue. But in certain circles, again, this is not an issue for them, because between the view of that assumes there's no prohibition at all, and view that assumes it doesn't apply in the context of religious singing, that was pushed aside. That wasn't even really an issue in this particular place where this took place. But the broader issue raised all kinds of support and opposition. And just to give a little brief synopsis, it reached a level where there were those who called for the ouster of this particular synagogue from the, whether it be the synagogue organization of the synagogue or the rabbinical organization of the rabbi, a whole tararam. And there was an actual formal statement, which I think, to my knowledge, is almost unprecedented, by the Orthodox Union, saying that this is an unacceptable breach and cannot be countenanced. And if you want more details, speak to Rabbi Weinreb, who was the executive director emeritus. So I recommend each and every one of you, if you're interested, you can call him up. I have his phone number, or you can email him. And if you want to report his opposition before next week's shiur, I'm happy to include it. I have no idea what his opposition is. All I know is that it was an unacceptable breach. You want to use the word usser? Do I only use the word usser? It goes back to our earlier discussion. I'm not putting words into the OU's mouth or into Rabbi Wadman's mouth, my friend Rabbi Wadman's mouth. So those who want to contact him, feel free. Now, there are a number of issues which have to be analyzed on a simply technical basis. One of them is, someone has to tell someone unfamiliar with the architecture of the particular institution, I don't get it. Where is this woman leading the prayer services from? Is she leading it from the men's side, or is she leading it from the woman's side? That's a logical question for anyone who has never been in that place to ask.
Half of her is in the men's section and half in the ladies' section.
From what I understand, having been there, there is a no man's land called the Bima. Now, the Bima being a no man's land, to my mind, is in itself automatically an automatic violation of the Shulchan Aruch. From the moment the synagogue was built, nothing to do with this. I'll explain to you why. The separation of men and women in a shul is a very, very basic halacha. Although it's hardly found, we spoke about this in a different context, it's hardly found explicitly in the Shulchan Aruch. There was a whole discussion of this, which led to the publication of a book called The Sanctity of the Synagogue by Baruch Litvin in Detroit, or some suburb thereof, Mount Clemens, something like that, right? Way back in the 50s, I believe. I think it's over 50. I have one, it's over 50 years old, and it's a masterpiece where he quotes all kinds of things from great rabbis in the whole spectrum, including my own Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, who was quoted there, as he wrote in the Yiddish newspapers then, before Rosh Hashanah, he wrote, one should not go to this, to a mixed seating synagogue, even if it means as a result, he will not hear the Shofar Rosh Hashanah. Now the mitzvah of Shofar Rosh Hashanah is a Torah commandment, to hear the Shofar. This is not a small thing, aside from the symbolic and the emotional, it's purely halachic, it's a mitzvah same in a Torah. And he said, do not go into such a place to hear the shofar. You can't deny that. That was written more than once in his own Yiddish style, with his own name, his own byline. It's undeniable. He also said,
it's not a big deal.
Not a big deal? Okay, good.
No,
the word big deal, how about this one? In another place he said, tell me if this is a big deal. He said, to go participate in such a service as Yehoreg V'al Yava. Is that a big deal? I don't want to be, what's the big deal about you? You'd rather get killed than to go there.
Okay, so I'll show you somebody who said Yehoreg V'al Yava and not shake a woman's hand.
I'm sure someone said it, but not Rav Soloveitchik. So there are many people who say many things, but it depends on who you're quoting. So he said it's Yehoreg V'al Yava for the simple reason that he viewed this idea of mixed seating as coming from an unholy source. It was coming from the reform, which copied it from the church. And he felt that it therefore has a abizrael the avodah zara / gilui arayos, the case may be, and therefore it's yehara gavayava. Simple as all that. Simple as all that. So, one of the sources in Shulchan Aruch for this halacha is the din in the Ramah that a woman who was honored is what we call in our language to be a kvaterin, means bringing the baby close to the bris milah, supposed to stand outside the shul, and the kvater, it's usually a husband, doesn't have to, but usually, takes the baby from her and brings the baby into the shul, indicating that a woman is not supposed to be in shul at all when the davening is happening. That's a pretty clear indication. The other indication we mentioned before is if there's a fight, chalila v'chas, not in this shul, a fight in the Ezra's Nashim, where men are not supposed to be able to see into, then a woman is permissible, is permitted to serve as a witness in a court of law on a bezin. Because how else? It's like in a birthing room. It was inconceivable that any man should be in a birthing room. Unheard of, right?
Still.
Well, depends where. So so therefore, the Gemara is in Kiddushin that a chaya, that a midwife, has credibility because there's no men there. What are you going to do? So too, that's the Vilna Gaon quote, says, so too in an Ezra's Nashim. See, once again, you see that A, there is an Ezra's Nashim, and B, by the way, you also see that men cannot see in. There seems to be a Mefurish in the Shulchan Aruch, almost again to what Moshe says. I mean, I don't want to argue with the Godel Adar. Moshe's view on the Chitz is to separate the socializing, but the factor, but it's against the Rambam Mefurish and Pirish and Mishnayis, and Smesech the Sukkah, and it seems to be against the Shulchan Aruch, because if you can see in, then why can't the men see when there's this fight going on in the Ezra's Nashim? I'm sure there's this kolus of brachim. I'm sure that they made an attractive noise, so everyone just turns around and looks. Apparently you can't see. Anyway, simple. That's a simple interpretation. Anyway, that's not the main point I'm bringing. So now, in certain synagogues, they decided to make men and women side by side. Well, that's okay. We had that in our shul as well. But then, they decided to make a joint... How should I say it? Bima. It's the best way I can say it. A large... the best way I can describe it is a boxing ring. That's the best way I can describe it. Which is in the middle of a big... It's huge. I'm not sure if it's the exact size of a boxing ring either. But that's the impression it gives to me. Which is accessible equally to men and women. That's the whole point. To men and women. And that's the place where they learn from. And that's the place where they daven sometimes from. And that's the place where the bris takes place. The whole story. Seems to be, before we even get to what we're discussing today, that's already a bittle of the, forgive me, the architecture of the basic Knesset as we've had it from time immemorial. Okay, so, you know, what are you going to do about it? That's people have different views of shul architecture. So that's the answer to the original question I was asked. Well, which side of the shul is this woman leading the Kabbalah Shabbos from? The answer is, she's leading the Kabbalah Shabbos from exactly the same place that the man led it from last week. But which side of the Mechitza? It's hard to explain to someone. It's sort of in between, you know.
Both sides can see it.
No, that mechitza is see through straight throughout. But this is an elevated place,
it's low.
Which is
very low.
Which
no,
is
higher.
It's elevated bima, but it's like imagine the mechitza going like this. Then it breaks out, makes a big boxing ring, and continues like that.
The mechitza is here, and the mechitza is over there,
and in between is a big box. Okay. So this seems to me, before you even start with any other of details, it's a major problem with what I call proper synagogue architecture. Okay. Of course, you can argue if that's the case, we can always solve that problem. You always solve a problem, so have a regular shul and have the woman lead the Kabbalah Shabbos from the women's section, one could have said. Never heard of it being done that way, because that maybe defeats the whole point. But I'm not sure what exactly the point is over here. That's exactly the problem. And then there were those who said, can't do it, because if you do it, next thing you know, the woman is going to lead the Ma'ariv service, which comes right afterwards. And guess what? Nafik mine churba. One thing is going to lead to another. It's a bad idea. One of my rabbinic colleagues wrote that he's not against innovation, but this is a bad idea because it's going to lead to the Ma'ariv service. A different one of his colleagues said, it's already bad. Not that it's going to lead to right now. Kabbalah Shabbos in our mind is part of the Ma'ariv service. Fine. I'm happy to hear that individuals who heretofore have been very staunch resistors of this nafik mine churba, we will sometimes call slippery slope argument, have finally come to their senses and realized This is part of the halachic process. And, you know, they already slid down so many feet till they woke up. I'm still up here. And after slung going out to here, they were, stop! Now maybe too late. You know, once the horses and the carriages are this far down the mountain, as you know, the Yisrael Salanta said, it's too late. You gotta get to the bottom before they can get them back up again. So it's a serious problem. I don't use invective. I didn't say anything about it. Whenever was asking me to baiting me to say this, I'm still saying nothing about it. I will endorse the position of the OU, broadly speaking. This is an unacceptable breach in what's been happening in our shuls since time immemorial. And I was told, although I'm not sure, that this institution no longer has this service. I'm not sure if that's true. Is it going on a weekly basis, or is it just a one-time event? I don't know. I was told that it was stopped because of the public outcry. Now, you know, I'm beginning to understand more and more that, you know, as it was mentioned before in the Shia, that we have to take into account the public position before we make the halachic stances, that's something which is an across-the-board kind of a consideration. Apparently, a women's tefillah group does not provoke an outrageous response for the precise reason that it's secessionist. It's secessionist. So it's taking place in a private place, whether it be in the synagogue building or beyond. So it doesn't happen in the shul itself. It happens in the shul itself, it provokes a greater outcry. And therefore, rabbis of all persuasions are a bit more cautious in advancing certain revolutions which take place in the, if I may use the expression, which are the main event in the center stage. So that having been said as an introduction, we have to discuss today's topic, which is Kriyas HaTorah. You already mentioned Hakafos, which is really sort of in between Tefillah and Kriyas HaTorah, when the women take the Sefer Torah on Simchas Torah. That's a bit in between, because it's, you know, it's really, Hakafos, you can say the same thing, it doesn't exist really too much in early sources. Some shuls didn't have it at all, as we well know. Nonetheless, the existence of Hakafos, when women taking the Sefer Torah, has been considered to be out of bounds, again by Rav Soloveitchik, because there's a breach, and he called it synagogue etiquette. We call that minig beis haknesses, and so it is quoted in Rabbi Mazelman's Sefer, which is, I believe, quite authoritative in this respect. And therefore, it pained me when, yes, you heard it again. In this tiny little neighborhood of ours, such a small little community, that this practice was begun in a particular synagogue. I happen to have been one of the people consulted, and I said, please don't do it. And it was done nonetheless. And it provoked a very significant response, even within our own community. I'm not going into the details right now, but it was a principled response that such kinds of activities really don't belong in our shuls. And without going into the specifics of usur, not usur, it's just, again, it's something which has never been done before, and something which is not acceptable to many people.
It was worse than that, because it was consisted of the Orthodox, Conservative, and the Reformed synagogue.
That's a different...
Out in the open street. That's
a separate story. I'm not going into that at all. I'm talking about within each particular synagogue. I'm not discussing community-wide. This happened in a particular synagogue, and a very distinguished, very, very distinguished rabbinic colleague decided as a result of that he doesn't want to be part of that shul anymore. Which is, you know, someone said to me, splintering. People have principles. Wasn't it the person innovated it with the blessing of any of the local rabbanim or the greater rabbanim or the rebbeim or anybody? Just that they do it somewhere else, they can do it here too. That's an insufficient reason to introduce such a change, and you know, the result is the result. Okay, so now let us turn our attention to... Yes?
Would it be considered innovation or against Minhag to basically ask for the woman to dance in Chasara?
I was asked that question myself 20 years ago. I gave my bracha to it.
What was the question?
Can women dance without a Sefer Torah? No, it happened, I think, a total of once. The women wanted to dance. I said, fine. I said, please pull the mechitza. which they did, and had a rikud in the front of the shul, and they had a rikud, fine, and then it's just noshim. That's I don't bother. That's that safer Torah that keeps me. That keeps that's the magnet, as we spoke about last time with the women's tefillah groups. I said, do without a safer Torah. You know, that would reduce some of the dafka. That's exactly the telling point over here.
They also couldn't sing. The women couldn't sing when they danced.
Listen, the men have louder voices than the women. We don't. We have never, in our shul, to my knowledge, had an issue that of kol isha, in the sense that the women who do sing, I'm sure there's some who do, but they sing in a low tone of voice, not in full voice, and I don't oppose that. I assume it happens. And the men's voices are, Kodesh Baruch Hu made them louder. You know, I guess if women wanted to sing very loud and to be heard, they would certainly be heard. But the women in our shul, cognizant of the fact that in this shul at least, Kol Yisha is a significant halachic issue, so they say they're sing the nigunim, which I'm sure they sing along, no question about, in a low voice. And the men don't hear it. Now, I don't sit right next to the mechitza. Anyone in the shul sit right next to the mechitza? Of all the people in the room today.
But I think there would be a difference between during davening and if they were dancing on purpose to dance and sing at the same time, they might sing much louder.
It happened once to my knowledge and I didn't hear anything. I guess the men are singing much louder on Simchas Torah as well. So, but since I think Eddie, you're the closest to the mechitza of everyone sitting in the room, because everyone else sits on the other side, you hear women singing during davening?
There's one that has a very bad voice.
So that's the answer. We generally speaking don't hear it. This, by the way, let's talk about it already now, since it's talking about women's tefillah. What about women saying Kaddish? Women saying Kaddish is another new issue, because in my youth it was unheard of. Literally unheard of. I never heard anywhere of a woman saying Kaddish when I grew up. In recent years it's become a point of contention again. Remember there was a debate at one of the conventions. I happened to have been present. I don't know what I was doing there, but there was between Rabbi Fink of Young Israel of New Rochelle, a neighboring shul, and Rabbi Luchstein of the KJ shul in Manhattan about this very point. And Rabbi Luchstein was in favor, Rabbi Fink was against, and it was quite a forceful debate. Probably can get it on tape, if I have the old tapes of the old conventions. And the main reason to be against is because it's a change in the minhag. If you look on the Chetshuv across the Chavos Yar, it's going to lead to Chalishas HaMenhagim, the weakening of the synagogue customs as a whole. We try to keep our customs intact. So therefore, if someone asks me who wants to say Kaddish, I said, listen, I'm not here against just saying Kaddish, but I don't want it to be heard. Because if it's going to be heard, it's going to cause a tumult. And it happened here in our shul. And the people were very unhappy with it. And that's the custom over here in this shul. If in a different shul, that's not the custom, the women say the Kaddish in a full voice, or maybe even only women saying Kaddish in a particular instance, that's the joke. Every rabbi has to have his own way of doing things. I'm not casting stones or aspersions. I believe in freedom of religion, and but at the same time, the free religion applies to me too. You know, I have a particular position which is according to Rabbi Fink that it should not be done. I feel strongly about it, and I feel it's the right way to go. We can't start changing him and hug him, as Rav Soloveitchik said, and we recorded him last time. You change one thing, and then another thing, and another thing, and they're going to end up with frustration at the end of the day. That's what's going to happen at the end of the day. So it's already happening. So in this shul, at least, if a woman wants to say Kaddish, she has to do so in an undertone. Now, Rav Shech has his own unique opinion that you're not permitted to say Kaddish from a properly constructed woman section, which was a position he took at the RCA convention, I believe, 7 years ago. It was he was subjected to some withering criticism, but he stood his ground. If you want to ask him about it, I'll make a pitch. In 1 hour, if you go to Dr. Grejava's house to hear Rabbi Shechter speak for Shalom Torah Centers, before he starts, or after he finishes, he's going to ask him this question, and I'm sure he'll provide you with a full answer. But we are supposed to speak about the next level. The next level is minyanim, which we call not women's tefillah, we'll call it either egalitarian minyanim, or sometimes called partnership minyanim. This is a new phenomenon. This didn't even exist when I signed my name 26 years ago to that famous, or some call infamous, called Kore, opposing women's tefillah. This was beyond anyone's imagination. But in the span of a generation, that's all it is. 26 years is a generation. Now it's already a matter of course in certain communities. most of them in the Holy Land, some of them in the island to our south. I don't know if it exists in any synagogues around Little Riverdale, but it may exist in certain private homes. I can't be accountable for what's going on in anyone's private house. What does this mean, a partnership or a egalitarian? What does it mean? It means exactly what it says, that everyone has exactly the same role, as much as possible within the what they consider to be halachic. And one of the major changes...
How is that different from mixing?
No, it's not mixing. Chas v'shal. That's not. It's absolutely separate seating. Only one problem. When it comes to Kriyas HaTorah, they give aliyahs not only to men, as has been traditional, but they give aliyahs to women as well. How they overcome the we'll call it the mechita problem, when the aliyahs are being given out, that is a problem. I imagine that they make an exception. The woman comes in to get an aliyah, and she goes back to the Ezra Stoshim. I don't know exactly how it works.
Rabbi shake hands with every woman who got an aliyah.
I would imagine he would probably plunge himself into the river before doing that, because according to you, it's Yehar Gvayav. So what's the scoop about this one? And you know what? This, in a certain sense, also started here. Believe it or not, yeah? The first learned article on this topic, to my knowledge, of significance, was put out by somebody who was a member of our, not just of our community, but of our shul. Till now, everything we said about it was out of our shul. Now, it really gets really close. Our shul, a member of our shul who subsequently moved to the Holy City, penned an article of a significant length, in which he says, he sent me the original version, which was an attack on women's tefillah as secessionist. That part was taken out of the later editions. But his antidote to that is, instead of having a secessionist women for women minion for women only, have a men's minion, and women can get aliyahs the same as men. It's explicit in the Gemara. What? Explicit? Yeah, it's explicit. Why? Because the Gemara says in Masechta Megillah Daf Chav Gimel Amud Aleph that a woman can get an aliyah. Depends where you stop. You know, you have to be careful whenever you quote a source. Where do you stop? Right. Just to give an example. Just to give you the puzzle, we say it every day. Shomer Hashem, Eskol Ohavav, V'Eskol Rishon. Or, one differently, right? Eskol Ohavav, V'Eskol Rishon Yashmit. Those are two ways to quote. I didn't lie, I quoted exactly verbatim from David HaMelech. Just that I left one word out here and two words out there. So you know, you can quote, if you quote selectively, you can find anything. So it says there, Beferish, Hakal Olam Laminyan Shiva. Everyone can count all the seven requisite individuals who read the Torah on the Shabbos. Afilu Isha, Afilu Kotam. Even a woman, even a minor. You stop right there, black on white. But then comes the critical line. What's the critical line? Avol Isha lo tikra, then they kvod atzibur. But a woman shall not read because of the kvod atzibur. What do you mean, shall not read? In those days, if you received the aliyah, as we call it, you were called up to the Torah, you read yourself. So a woman is prohibited. There's a discussion of this too. Another rabbi jumped into the fray. His name is Rabbi Sperber, from the Holy City. And he made a whole to-do over the fact that never used the word asr. Here we go again. Don't say asr. Isha lo tikra. The woman shouldn't read. Okay. Make kvod atzibur because of the honor of the congregation. So, the author of the initial article said, it's very good. He agrees completely. He's absolutely and unalterably opposed for a woman to receive an aliyah, any shul, with even one voice of opposition. One. There's one person, male or female, is opposed. He's also opposed. But, if there's unanimity, if everyone agrees that they are, quote, mochel al kvodo, it's kvod atzibur, it's the honor of the congregation. Right? There's the concept of mochel al kvodo, ha'av shemochel al kvodo, kvodo mochel. Ha'rav shemochel al kvodo, kvodo mochel. So he says, well, look too, ha'tzibur shemochel al kvodo, kvodo mochel. If they can in effect forego the honor which is given to the tzibur, for which reason a woman should not receive an aliyah. And if every single person in the room, in the congregation, in the shul, foregoes this so-called honor, so it's for God, and therefore the woman, nothing more than the woman getting an aliyah, black on white. It's a Gemara.
What honor are they
over? Question. What's up? Let's go. You're asking an excellent question. An excellent question. What does it mean, kvod atzibur? It's a good question. Unfortunately, the Talmud is very terse and does not tell us what does it mean, kvod atzibur. So I'll throw out for the audience participation. How do you interpret the words kvod atzibur? What tramples on the honor of the community if a woman instead of a man receives an aliyah? What's so terrible? You have a suggestion, anybody?
He also made this in that article. The gentleman happens to be in Riverdale this Shabbos.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'd like to see him. He had a personal problem. I called him up when he was
talking on the subject. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. I'm happy to see.
It's a distinction if you have the service in someone's home.
We'll get to that later. Right. That is a citation from a little known sefer called the Sefer HaBatim. The Sefer HaBatim is a commentary on the Rambam, and he makes a point that it only applies if it's done in a shul, which is a tzibur, but if it's done in a private home, then there's no real tzibur to speak of. It's a private home. The balabas does it the way he wants. That is an opinion. It exists out there. Let me, since you raised that point, let me digress for a moment. One of the major issues which is at hand in this entire series is the role of what we'll call minority opinions. Now, halachists are always aware of minority opinions, even from distinguished rabbis, which are, you know, significant in terms of a discussion, but often not at all significant when it comes to the bottom line. There are numerous minority opinions. Let's think of an example, okay? Take medicine. Someone is dealing with a serious medical condition, and the medical community at large, 99%, feel a certain way. And there's one minority opinion that feels a completely different way. Someone comments to me and say, can I rely on that 1%? I said, you're crazy. 99% of the doctors think this is, you're killing yourself. Yeah, but I like that doctor, you know, it appeals to me. I don't have to lose weight, I don't have to stop smoking, I don't have to... I rely on a minority opinion. If you ask me, it's irresponsible. In all areas, there's a consensus, and there are minority views here and there, you know, in certain situations. The same thing applies over here. You find, today it's not so hard to find. Everyone can pull out a Bar-Ilan, you know, if you know what I mean. The Bar-Ilan is not the university itself. Barad University put out a CD-ROM which has everything on it, and there's more, now even more, this is DBS, there's so many Oster HaChochma, what do they do? You press a button, Kriyasar and Noshim, and Alokam will spit out 1,000 sources, and yeah, one of them will say what you just said, Sefer HaBatim, which says that it's only a problem in the shul, which is a tzibur, and not in a private home. I believe it's a minority point of view, and it's not even reckoned with by the halachists in general. Now, again, I'm not casting stones or aspersions on anyone, but I'm just pointing out that minority views are often dangerous when they are adduced to solve a quote issue or a problem to somebody's liking. Minority views are always given their due deference. It also depends who the minority is. You know, how great is whoever heard in this room before tonight of the Sefer HaBatim? You heard of it? Oh, I'm impressed. There's a minority of one who heard of the Sefer HaBatim, but most people never even heard of it. Let's not take away from the greatness of the author. Just it's not so much in the mainstream. Probably in the Rabbams. We can bring it out right now. We have it if you want to pull out the Sefer.
Five different commentaries. We only have it
so we can disagree with it.
No, I don't mind citing it. As a matter of fact, I have it written right in front of me, and the article I have cites it. I'll try to get to it later on. In any event, but what is... I never got the answer to my question. What is kavod atzibur? What's wrong if a woman receives an aliyah? Why does it somehow affront the honor of the congregation? That's the question. Who has an answer? Yes?
No, could it just possibly be you're taking away the opportunity from a man?
So what? Why should a man be entitled more than the woman?
Well, normally he's spending his life learning Torah and more involved in... and those kind of things, if he should be better at it and more knowledgeable of it, and she's
you're talking
raising the family.
But what if she's more knowledgeable than he is? There are many women who are more knowledgeable than men. I can find a group of, let's say, 15 people in a room, right? So I have to get 8 people to call up for the Sefer Torah, and there are 10 men, and there are 5 women, and it's very possible that there are 5 women who are more educated than at least 5 of the men in the room. So by calling to you, we should call up those 5 women. Yes?
Well, I think, you know, like going back to our first, shiurim,
right,
that in that time of the Gemara and at the time of the Rishonim, etc., the status of a woman in society was much lower, and they were not educated. And they were not, you know, so calling somebody up to a position like that was denigrating to men who felt that she wasn't on their level of society.
Okay.
That's what it was.
Very good. I hear a few different suggestions. I'm going to give you a much simpler suggestion. Two much more simple suggestions. One is given by Rabbi Kapach, who was a famous Rav, Zichron Levracha, was a major force in the halachic community, though he had also certain minority positions, but he was considered a big Talmud Chacham. And he says, it's very simple, she doesn't count to a minyan. She doesn't count to a minyan, so he knew you need 10 people to be part of the tzibur. So it's not part of Kavanat Tzibur that a woman who cannot count to a minyan, for reasons you spoke about, you're right, in the opening, we mentioned our suggestion as to why. And if whatever reason why, the reason is irrelevant. We know she doesn't count to a minyan, so it would be beneath the cover of the tzibur that someone who doesn't count, cannot constitute a tzibur, should be the one who was representing the tzibur. That's his understanding. I would say that a more common understanding is the fact that, as we spoke about in the subsequent shiur, that women are exempt from Talmud Torah. Doesn't mean they're not advanced in Talmud Torah. It's very possible that, as I said before, in a particular room, that there could be women who are much more educated than the men. But this doesn't change the fact that, technically speaking, a man is obligated to study Torah every waking moment. He has an obligation of a gisa b'yom v'layla to study all the time. And the woman, although she's obligated, as we spoke about at great length, to know the basics of halacha and the basics of hashkafa, but she's not required to be studying the Torah in every free moment. And therefore it's not appropriate that a woman who is not obligated to study Torah on that level should be reading from the Torah. And to be more specific, according to almost all authorities, a woman is exempt from the Kriyas HaTorah. The Kriyas HaTorah service itself, there is a minority view, but the majority view is that she's exempt from that, which makes sense given the fact she's exempt from studying the Torah. So she's exempt from the Kriyas HaTorah. So it's not right that a woman who is exempt from Kriyas HaTorah should be the one who's representing the community in the actual Kriyas HaTorah as such. Yes, and then there are those who say that it's a matter of tznius. That is correct. There is an opinion which indicates that. It's not appropriate for the woman to receive the aliyah in the, we'll call it, egalitarian or partnership minyan. It would be a distraction to the men who are supposed to be focused on their Torah and on their tefillah. Now there are those who will say today it's no longer a distraction. Men are used to hearing women speak in a public forum. Others will count and say, yes, men are used to being distracted by the women. You know, so I'm not here to arbiter that dispute, but certainly in a synagogue where it never happened before such a thing, it can easily see what would be a distraction to a man. And there were those who went further and said, you know, if a woman is going to receive an aliyah and she's exempt from Tefillas HaTorah and never happened before, they're going to come to a conclusion that it's desperation. There's nobody else who knows that Elaine but her, so she's going to be the one to read, and that's a poor impression is conveyed to the tzibur. There's no one there no male there who knows Elaine, so we have to resort to a woman reading from the Torah. Now there can be all kinds of differences between these various issues. Can she be the Balkari? Can she be the Ola? Everyone can lead to different conclusions. There's an interesting issue about Kolisha over here as well. What does it mean? Is it Isha of Kovarat Tzibur? So some say, that's what it means, Kol Isha, because she's going to chant with the trup, and that itself is the Kovarat Tzibur which you speak. It's a veiled reference to the prohibition of Kol Isha. In any event, it seems that there are a whole variety of understandings as to what does Kovarat Tzibur mean. And we already rattled off 4 or 5 reasons of our own. Anyone have any other suggestions? I'm willing to, since there's nothing definitive, you can have, you can suggest your own. Yes?
I think we often see in the political statement that the woman is doing this because they want to make a point, a political point, and not necessarily because she actually wants to do it for other reasons, but I think that they want to kind of be out there and say, we're doing this because we want to make a
statement. That's a modern approach, and I'm not saying it's wrong in the modern context. It seems to me that when this statement was read in the Gemara Masechta Megillah and Afchav Gimel, it was long before those kind of political statements were being made. So I don't think it really meant, to be honest with you. I mean, I like the shot, but I think it's really sort of reading in backwards to the to a source which goes back a few thousand years. So I hear, but I wouldn't understand it in that fashion. So I have in front of me a mimer, which I'm willing to, again, to lend to you if you want for your comments for next week. Time is almost up. It's entitled Aliyat Nashim LaTorah, and it's written not by a rabbi even. It's written by a very learned gentleman. His name is Eliav Shochatman. He has spoken in Ashul. Yes, he's related I believe, Dr. Rachel Orzabel. And he was here for Shabbos, and right away I gave him the opportunity to speak, because he's a distinguished individual, written a number of important svarim. And here, he has written this article, which is spans 75 pages, not a small article, and then written in Hebrew. And he takes these authors to task. I don't know exactly what year this is written. Unfortunately, I can't do it, because I don't have on the top, they have just, you know, the name of the article and the author on all many pages. I believe it came from something called Shana B'Shana, and it's clearly something in the last number of years, because he's quoting from spring of 2003. So obviously it's something which came sometime after that. It's been written in the last 7 years. Okay? And he speaks about this at great length. I'm just going to give you a few chapter headings in the first part, and maybe we'll continue if we don't finish. We're not going to. A little bit the next time, but next time we're going to a completely different topic. If you look at the list of topics, we're finally getting out of the how we call it, the mitzvah cessation of Angaroma and Torah and Tefillah and Kriyas of Torah, which is really the first unit, to the other, perhaps even more controversial ones about tzniyus and women covering their hair and covering their body. That's the general range of topics. But again, I reserve the right, as always, to devote the first part of the Shia to what's left from the previous week. I can't just end on exactly my topic at 8 o'clock and say, well, now we just finished. I don't have that ability. If I did, I wouldn't be able to take any questions, that's for sure. So I think it's more important to take questions, even if we're going to have overlaps on a weekly basis from one Shia to another. So here, if you those want to look it up, it starts on page Resh Ayin Aleph, and it goes approximately 75 pages. He quotes the Gemara Masechta Megillah, and he gives various reasons for her not being able to get an adikat of kavarat tibur, and it's quite a remarkable outcome to that. Since there's so many different understandings, most of which we already shared, he comes to the following conclusion. Again, I'm skipping to about 20 pages into the article. Oh, he does quote the Sefer Abatim. For those who want to, it's a full disclosure. The Sefer Abatim is quoted over here. On page Reish Sadi Gimel Sefer Abatim, the Perush of the Rambam. Take that back. It's called Beis Tefila Shach Kriyas HaTorah Shach Sheni Vav. Reb Hirschl printed it. Yushalayim Tovshin Mem Gimel on page Reish Lamed Vav. Look it up. Yesh Min Hagadolim Shekasa Shemispalim B'Boteim Ba'Asara. The dam of the minyan in their own private homes. Isha Koresha Batorah. Shor Nikra Tibur Elok Shemispalim Bebeis HaKnesses. This is what the Sefer Abatim writes. And there are those who claim that the Rambam holds that way. Now, as unknown as the Sefer Abatim is, that's how well known the Rambam is. But as Rabbi Professor Shulchan explained, there's really no basis to assume that the Rambam ever meant that. And therefore, it goes back to its minority view status. Who was he? Rav David Kochavi was a chacham who lived in Provence in the 14th century, and Sefer Abatim was never known. It was only in a manuscript. No one really saw it, and Rav Yosef Kaur didn't quote this, and he says therefore that he finds mitzios chadashot kosa chasazish that was never brought through the as he puts it the kurach hituch hayel chatish nifchan adoros was not put through the ringer of halachic analysis to all the generations. It cannot really be taken that all that seriously. Okay, now based upon the fact that we don't really know the reason for this, because there's so many different reasons, we cannot then say, well, since the reason no longer applies, so the halacha no longer applies, because we don't even know the reason. Even if we knew the reason, because again, 20 pages into the article, he starts with Reish Ayin, now it's in Reish Tzadis. He says, even if we knew the reason for the takana, and we could argue that the reason no longer applies, which is a possibility, which some have brought up, right? Some have brought up. Nonetheless, the halacha remains. The halacha remains. It's an absolute halacha, and even if the reason no longer exists, the exists nonetheless. Yes.
What about if you mentioned Nashim and also Titanic? So, what, according to that Gemara, Titanic would be able to vote to get the Aliyah.
As a matter of fact, in some shuls, Titanic are given Aliyahs, in some shuls. Our shul has had a custom not to give a cotton an Aliyah, but there's some shuls to this day give a cotton Aliyah. Some of them only Maftis, some say Aliyah.
Huh?
Okay, different customs in different places. In any event, I quote from this author, Reish Tzadi Aleph. Since the understanding of Torah Tzibur is not clear, he thinks, quote, Shadavar Rak Machbid, in bold, Alef Sharut Lecholel Shinui Balacha Kovas Yishalat Yigabatorah. In other words, if you knew the reason and the reason is Botel, so then some are going to write in some limited cases, Botel Atam, Botel Is. Okay, some. But if you don't know the reason, then you can't get started. Since we don't know the reason, there are five different reasons we set ourselves. So therefore, forget about it. Here's a whole digression of a few pages, even if the reason is bottled, then it's the kayim. But in this case, as we said before, we're not even sure what the reason is, and the reason very likely still does exist. We now come, and I'm going to have to end with this, and maybe we'll pick it up next time, to the Marami Rutenberg. This is famous. The Marami Rutenberg is referring to a case which I've, by definition, never seen. The only person in this room who could have possibly seen this is Mr. Shabbos. He could have seen it. No one else in this room could have even seen it. What's unique about Mr. Shabbos?
Kohen.
Is it Kohen? Ir Shakula Kohanim. A city of all Kohanim. What happens is they have a Kriyas HaTorah in a city of all Kohanim. So the Marami Rutenberg has this incredible halacha. Marami Rutenberg was a very much mainstream posek. He was the architect of
one Kohen after the other.
Right. You're not permitted to call one Kohen after. What do you do? I'm going to read it to you. I'll read it to you from the Marami Rutenberg. It's something which is can be found. It's not a secret. The Mordechai quotes in the Masechta Gittin, Siman Tov Dalet. You can find it. It's quoted in the bottom of the Rambam in this halacha. Tefillah Yud Beis Yud Zayin Os Reish. It's found. This is not a secret, and this is not a out of the way posuk. Marami is a very mainstream posuk, as we will find, as we've already found. Even the words of very mainstream poskim are sometimes themselves not mainstream and have been rejected by the later authorities despite the magnitude of the authority of the person who originally said it. This is a case in point. Let me read the Maram. Nearly, the Kohen Kore Pa'amayim. The Kohen reads twice. Now this could happen. I can't see that. Eddie, you can't see that because we're Levi. But if there's no Levi, the Kohen reads twice. That happens. I'm sure that's happened to you at one point or other.
Many
times. Okay. Fine. V'chvishuv yikru noshim. After the Kohen got twice, now we call women. A woman's not supposed to become covered at Tzibur. Hecha the lo efsher, when there's no alternative, yidache kvod at Tzibur, you put aside the kvod at Tzibur, mipnei, important to know, pigam kohanim akorim. Because otherwise, we're going to blemish the yichus of the later Kohanim. What are we going to think? Shlo Yomru B'nei Gurusho say. If they get an Aliyah from Shlishi and on, they'll say they're not really, his father's a Kohen, as the famous joke goes. Yeah, his father's a Kohen, but he married a divorced woman, therefore he's not a Kohen. That would be a terrible thing. So rather than suffer that terrible pagam, which is a pagam, is a blemish in the kohen. So rather than do that, we'll forego the kavod atzibur. So writes the Maharam. Now, my time is up. This is tantalizing, is it not? I can easily find women who will ask ten kohanim to please come with them. Right? I mean, it's easy to say. I can find ten kohanim. And you get ten kohanim, come into the room with us. So we know, and then the Rambam would work. That's an easy solution. The room with ten kohanim, so they can find some avant-garde kohanim friends. They'll establish them in ten kohanim, so we know, and then we'll pull out the Maram, and we'll call it theirs, right? Tune in next week, as they say. But just to say about Irish, just on the end with this, we should never think that this can't happen. And I quote my esteemed colleague who's here for Shabbos, I call him my name, Rabbi Joel Cohen Shalita, a former principal of SAR, who told me he learned this as a child. Can't happen. Irish Shakula Kalam, it just can't happen. He said it happened. How did it happen? An unfortunate case in which, unfortunately, in the shul that they used to daven in, it was the Queen Jewish Center in Forest Hills, unfortunately, someone passed away in shul on Shabbos or Yom Tov. And Kohanim Alois, the Kohen had to leave right away. So all the Kohanim went to his house or maybe Khan's house, one of the. And they had an ear shakulo kohanim. It happened.
Taking a couple of Yisrael along.
I don't know what they did exactly. Maybe some how they had a lay. I don't know what they did exactly. But it happened.
We had a situation where half were cool
then. That's a different. Okay, maybe they would apply, but I don't think so. I don't think the problem of pagam applies. We'll stop here. We then the next time we'll just complete this. I hope fairly briefly, and then I'll go on to the next topic. Shavuot.